Dream turned into a wail. Another long beam of pale wood had stretched up and punched right out of her chest through her left boob. She flailed at the foot and a half of wood stretched out in front of her, howling more every time she moved it. A third shaft appeared in the ground between Claudia and Phoebe. They each flinched away from it. Another one grazed Phoebe's ribs, getting an angry roar from her, and Murdoch realized the spears weren't coming out of the ground. They were coming from the treetops. He stepped back without thinking, and another spear hit the ground next to him. It stabbed through a palm frond with a loud crack and trembled next to his knee. He took another step back, then looked over at Abe and Veek. He turned just in time to see a spear punch Abe in the chest. The man's breastbone cracked like driftwood as the long shaft impaled him. His big creature from the Black Lagoon hands came up, but only one of them made it far enough to hook a claw into the portion of the spear that hadn't passed through him. Abe spat out a mouthful of blood, coughed out some pinkish foam, and then retched more, darker blood. A rifle barked out a quick burst of bullets, followed by a single blast and a woman's scream. Veek's knee came up and hot pain exploded in Murdoch's nuts. It shot through his gut and up his spine, almost doubled him over, nearly dropped him to his knees. One hand went to his crotch while the other made a grab at Veek's arm. She twisted away and passed him. He swung his head back to Abe. He'd stopped coughing up blood, and now the trails of red just ran down his chin onto his shirt. He'd also stopped moving and breathing. In the space of a minute, his eyes had gone from accusing to agonized to dull and still. Murdoch took a breath, tried to push past the throbbing pain between his legs, and looked around. Figures dropped from the trees, their cloaks opening around them like leathery wings. The seraphs of legend, just as he'd been told in so many sermons and classes. One hurled a spear as it dropped, and it punched straight through Claudia's shoulder. The blow knocked her to the ground. Anne still stood tall. Blood soaked her left arm. She looked beautiful and angry. Her chest expanded with a deep breath, and she shouted a few guttural sounds. The seraph closest to her paused, its spear up, ready to impale Daniel. All around the clearing, the gaunt figures paused, their hooded skulls turning toward Anne. A few stepped toward her.
"Lower your rifles,"
Anne called out. She followed it with a few more sounds. They weren't noises a human throat was designed to make with any degree of volume or projection, and Murdoch could hear them rasping on her vocal cords.
"Minister," said Barnabas, "I'm not sure it's wise to—" "Guns down," she snapped. "We won't greet the heralds of our great lords with violence." "It's how they greeted us," muttered Judah, a little too loud.
When he caught Anne's fiery stare, he bowed his head and hesitantly slung his rifle over his shoulder.
"Your forgiveness, minister."
The seraphs moved closer. They didn't lower their weapons, but their stances were less hostile, more curious. Murdoch used the moment to glance around the forest area. Spears had killed Paul, Hannah, and Abe. Apparently, the last high-pitched scream he'd heard had been Gideon. The man had been skewered from two different directions, and the crossed spears gave him the look of a propped-up scarecrow. Claudia sprawled on the ground, writhing a bit, bleeding a lot, but overall looking very much alive. Veek had vanished. So had the old man. Murdoch had no clue if they'd run off together in separate directions or if the seraphs had plucked them up and carried them away. He counted seven seraphs. Four hung back, their long spears held across their bodies. The three others had moved even closer, looming over Anne. A radiant smile spread across her face. Blissful, almost. She looked up into the hooded face of the creature looming over her, slowly gnashing its teeth.
"I've waited so long to find you again," she said to it.
16. Chase stood on the beach and stared out at the sea. The winds sprayed salt water into his face, and he had to tell himself to blink it away. He took another breath, gulping in the cold air. He tried, for a third time, to wrap his mind around what he saw. A slithery sound reached his ears, followed by a soft thud, and he managed to look away from the sea, just for a moment. Doug's shoulders had gone so limp his backpack had slipped right off. It flopped on the sand at his feet, then slowly tipped over. Seth's head bobbed back and forth like a man in sincere agreement or deep in prayer. He raised his pistol toward the sea, then let it drop back to his side. Raised it, let it drop. Raise, drop. Each time, his breathing grew more frantic. And then, the sea. The impossible thing out at sea snared Chase's attention again.
"That's," he heard Doug say, "that's a cloud, right? It's just clouds."
"No," whispered Seth, just loud enough to be heard over the wind and waves.
At this distance, almost halfway to the horizon, the Makara could have been a toy. Chase could make out the tiny colored rectangles of shipping containers and the irregular mound of the ship's wheelhouse. It looked almost exactly like it had when they'd left the ship barely 3 hours ago, when he'd glanced back over his shoulder at it and seen the storm clouds rolling closer. The storm had reached the ship. The storm. His mind rebelled again. He stopped taking in air and had to will himself to breathe again.
"It's not clouds," he said, and his voice seemed so small and weak in the presence of the thing.
The thing above the ship. It had to be above the ship, because if he was seeing it over the ship, past the ship, it meant the thing was even bigger than it looked, made small by distance. And the thing looked huge. It looked enormous. When he'd first caught sight of it, he'd tried to convince himself he was seeing some once-in-a-lifetime natural wonder. A dozen, maybe as many as 2 dozen waterspouts or tornadoes, all stretching between the clouds and the ocean, churning up a spray of mist and foam. It made his heart race, remembering his awful week back in Houston during the hurricane. But they weren't tornadoes. Or clouds. At least, it wasn't all clouds. The monstrous thing in the sky had tentacles. Huge, curling pillars of flesh stretching hundreds of feet down to the water. Chase couldn't see any other features. No mouth or nose. He couldn't even see eyes, just so many tentacles. 2 gigantic wings spread out above it. They had long spines and swooping edges like bat wings or dragon wings. They were impossibly huge. Each one had to be at least as long as the Makara, but he thought they might even be larger. They almost blotted out the horizon. They stretched so far, their ends lost in the dark storm clouds surrounding the monster. It slid slowly through the sky, so slow as if it needed time to push whole mountains of air out of its way. It drifted past the Makara and began to turn through the air. The dark clouds hid its full length, and Chase didn't have any real sense of how far back it went. He trembled again, horrified by the idea that it could be farther away than he thought, that it could be even larger than he thought, even though his mind was barely able to accept it now. From somewhere behind all the tentacles, somewhere back in a body he couldn't fully see, 2 long, gaunt limbs hung down. Arms with claw-like hands? Legs with talon-like feet? He couldn't even begin to guess, and the 2 limbs were the most relatable part of the thing. A bolt of lightning arced down to the ocean, maybe from the clouds, maybe from the monster.
The tentacles reached down into the sea, curled back up, and reached down again. The water stretched up after it, as if it couldn't let go, as if gravity briefly reversed and the sea fell up toward the monster. A double rumble of thunder rolled across the waves and up onto the beach. It passed them by and went echoing into the forest. Another bolt of lightning lit up beneath the creature. Even as the tentacles dragged the ocean up toward the beast, they dragged memories up in Chase's mind. Role-playing games when he was a kid. Monster movies when he was older. Monster movies from... Doug made a whimpering noise. Seth raised his pistol again and jabbed it at the air.
No,
he said. Then he shouted at the beast.
No!
Chase made another attempt to look away from the thing in the sky and failed again. He tried to raise his hands, and a few seconds later his palms pressed over his eyes, hiding the Titan from his view.
Can you hear it? Said Doug. The thunder sounds like words. Like it's talking with the thunder.
Don't listen to it. The voice jerked Chase's head around, jolting his hands from his face. A young man stood a few dozen yards down the beach from them. He had shaggy black hair, and his skinny arms held a brass telescope, the kind used in old pirate movies. He stared intently through it, then let it drop and turned to look at Chase with dark eyes. That's your ship, yes?
I... sort of, yes.
How large is it?
What?
Chase glanced out toward the Makara and felt his gaze drifting back to the monster. The man snapped his fingers, catching Chase's attention again.
How large? I'm trying to compare sizes. What is that thing?
Chase asked as another wave of thunder crashed on the beach.
Do you know?
How large is your ship?
She's an old Panamax, said Seth.
He blinked away his dazed stare and focused on the man.
294 meters long.
Exactly?
Seth nodded. The man nodded, and the fingers of his free hand did a quick dance against his thumb.
Then it's one of the small ones, he said.
Chase took a breath, then took a good look at the man. He was mid-twenties at best, several inches shorter than Doug, maybe the same height as Seth. The man wore a threadbare white shirt under a khaki explorer's vest that had seen better days. What looked like a homemade tool belt wrapped around his waist, with one large pouch riding on his hip.
Who are you?
Asked Chase.
Have you been on the island this whole time?
What is that thing?
Barked Seth. The man waved the questions away.
Listen to me carefully, he said, pointing back into the jungle. Run. Go that way, about 3/4 of a mile. You'll be near the center of the island. You'll be safe there for now.
Chase risked a quick glimpse at the impossible Titan up in the sky, then back to the man.
What?
The man collapsed the telescope and dropped it into the hip pouch. Trust me, run. You'll be safe. Doug spun around, scooped up his backpack, and lumbered across the sand toward the trees. Chase got a quick look at his face as he stomped past and saw bright red tears running down his cheeks. Bloodshot veins stretched across the white of one of Doug's eyes, and the other one had gone completely red. How long had Doug been staring at the thing without blinking? How long had all of them been staring at it before the stranger had appeared next to them? Without thinking, he looked back at the ocean. The creature had completed its slow turn and soared through the air back toward the Makara. As he watched, the wings made a single downward thrust at the air. The clouds whirled and spun around them like an avalanche in the sky. The ocean recoiled, making waves big enough he could see them from miles away. Something grabbed his arm and shook it. Chase blinked, looked away from the ocean, and met Seth's gaze. He looked nervous, almost scared, and Chase wondered if Seth was thinking the same thing about him.
Do we trust him?
Do we have a choice? Seth nodded once and marched away, following Doug's messy footsteps across the beach. Chase took a step to follow him, and his foot snagged on something, almost tripping him. He looked at Iman's body, sprawled face down in the sand where they'd dropped it, dead on the beach. The young stranger pulled something else from his pouch, a small, rough notebook. He scribbled in it with a stubby pencil, glancing up at the beast again as he did, as if for reference.
You should follow your friends, he said.
How can you do that? Chase whispered.
Do what?
Look at it. How can you look at it without
going mad?
Yeah. It's a shock at first, but it gets easier. You've seen them before?
Too many times. He glanced up from his notes and waved a hand toward the tree line.
I'll explain what I can when I catch up with you.
Chase risked another quick look out to sea, taking in all he could in a glance. The titanic thing drifted through the clouds. Or did the clouds come out of it? Maybe its sheer size attracted them as it pushed its way through weather patterns. Its tentacles dipped lower into the sea below it, and the water reached up like iron filings stretching toward a magnet. Chase stepped over Iman's body and stopped next to the stranger.
What is it? If you've seen it before, you must have some idea what it is.
Oh, yes, said the man.
He looked at Chase with sad, dark eyes.
It's the end of everything. It's the end of the world.
17. Katanga had seen the thing in the sky almost half an hour ago when it came out of the storm rolling in behind Makara. He assumed it to be a trick of the light. What else could it have been? A particularly dark cloud and a few waterspouts coming together to fool his eye. He'd marveled at it, shot a picture with his smartphone, and gotten on with the deck inspection. But whenever he looked back, the illusion hadn't faded. The moment never came when the elements fell apart and the creature vanished. By the time he admitted a monster was approaching the ship, half a dozen members of the crew stood at the railing, all staring up with different levels of slack-jawed horror as storm clouds blotted out the sun and the air grew cold around them. Wind pulled at them as the thing soared by Makara. Its tentacles swept through the water, and Katanga watched the waves slosh up at it like... No. The creature sucked the water up. The long tentacles were like sponges, drawing everything in. Its skin pulled at the clouds swirling around it and the mist coming off the ocean. Thunder reached his ears, and Katanga somehow understood the creature was eating everything. The words echoed in his ears, in his mind, that it was so hungry. Its hunger was a deep, endless void, and it would eat the world to try to fill that vast emptiness. Even the air itself. The massive beast didn't push a wave of pressure out in front of it. The wild winds moved toward it as it drew them in and devoured them. And after its last turn, it was coming right at them. He shook away his awe and terror and ignored the latest thunderclap hammering his ears.
Everyone away from the railing, he bellowed. Get to safety.
Nowhere safe,
muttered Corwin, the second engineer. He stared up at the thing in the clouds without blinking. Blood ran from his eyes like tears. It moved closer, blotted out the sky, and night fell across Makara. Katanga couldn't comprehend anything so big. His brain fell down rabbit hole after rabbit hole, trying to find a comparison, trying to find words for anything so gigantic, and failing again and again. He forced past it, grabbed Corwin by the arm, and dragged him away from the railing. The tentacles stretched down and plunged into the water on either side of the ship. Waves crashed up onto the deck and rocked the vessel side to side. An awful lurch of motion wrenched Katanga's gut, a shift in direction,
as the Titan grabbed hold and dragged Makara along with it. One of the crew stumbled and caught himself against a dark blue shipping container. Corwin fell to his knees, still staring up at the sky. Blood leaked from his nose now. Katanga hooked an arm under the man's shoulder and dragged him across the deck. Off to their right, on the ship's port side, one of the massive tentacles flexed and shifted. It dimly reminded Katanga of one time he'd been up close to an elephant. Just a massive wall of skin and muscle stretching almost to the edges of his vision. The railing pressing against that wall of flesh cracked and vanished. Where the creature touched the ship, the metal rusted, flaked apart, and vanished into the tentacles. Something exploded next to him and sent him stumbling back. He let Corwin slip from his grasp as he covered his ears. Another explosion went off and made him flinch. By the third, Katanga managed to turn his head and look. Captain Hagen pumped the shotgun and blasted the tentacle again. And again. And again. The gun ran dry and he fumbled a handful of shells from his pocket, thumbing them into the tube as fast as he could. Katanga glanced at the tentacle. Hagen had emptied a shotgun into it and the flesh was barely torn. He could have been shooting it with a child's air gun. As Katanga watched, the small amount of damage the captain had managed to inflict swelled and knit itself back together. Hagen pumped the shotgun and fired again. Pump, shoot, pump, shoot, pump, shoot. His arms shook from the effort of working the weapon again and again. He emptied it and pulled more shells from his coat pocket. Part of Katanga knew he should run to the bridge, grab another shotgun from their hidden weapons locker, and join the captain in defending Makara. He could grab two or three shotguns, maybe grab the P-90 tucked away in the back too, arm whatever crew members he could find, and they could try to drive the monster away. He also knew in his heart they were doomed. The hungry thing in the sky above them would devour them all. Nothing could stop it. The ship leaned to the side with a deep groan of metal. The storage container squealed against their lashings. The lines hummed with tension in return. Katanga braced his feet and one hand on the deck, while Hagen wobbled and shifted his legs to keep his balance. Corwin rolled across the deck until he slammed into another container. A bolt of lightning whited out the world as thunder hammered Katanga's ears. The deck lurched under his feet again before he could blink all the spots from his eyes. He'd heard a scream swallowed up by the wind and waves and the groaning of the ship, a clatter of metal on metal that faded right away. Then he could see again. Hagen's shotgun had vanished, so had Corwin. The captain looked at him with a horrified face.
"We have to abandon her!" Hagen cried out.
"I know,"
Katanga shouted. The idea terrified him, so did the absolute certainty of it. Neither of them hesitated.
"The lifeboats,"
yelled Hagen, staggering away.
"Get everyone to the port lifeboats, they'll be clear."
A smart call, Katanga thought. Makara already listed hard to that side. He'd have made the same decision if his brain were firing on all cylinders. He grabbed the small radio from his belt and called up to the wheelhouse.
"We are abandoning ship," he yelled into it. "Call it. All hands abandon ship. Port lifeboats."
No one answered him. Chabra should have been there at the helm with Kazuya, but maybe they were already running for the lifeboats on their own. Maybe the sight of the tentacled thing in the sky had shattered their minds and left them with bleeding eyes and noses, like Corwin. Katanga switched channels and called out his orders again. Then he tried a third time, making his way across the sloping deck as he did. He pressed down with his heels, like working his way down a steep hill. He tossed the radio aside and let himself slip to the next bank of shipping containers, using their edges like rungs on a ladder. Makara had four lifeboats. The two on either side of the wheelhouse were bigger, high-tech, and closed models. Well, high-tech 10 years ago. Hagen had never pushed for upgrading them, and truth be told, the crew had pulled some supplies out of them over the years. Still,
They were decades ahead of the inflatables toward the bow. Katanga came around the corner of the container stack and saw the railing and the sea. The water sloshed and frothed far closer than it should have, and a twinge of fear reminded him if he slipped, he'd most likely go right over or under the rail and into the ocean below. Hagen stood a few yards away, working the davits for the lifeboat, and there was Kazuya and someone else in a yellow jumpsuit, his back to Katanga. The crew hadn't done an actual drill with the small cranes in close to a year, and they hadn't gotten any solid maintenance in at least that long. Another bolt of lightning lit up the sky. The thunder pummeled him. He glanced back, saw the huge tentacle on this side of the ship flex. Makara wailed again. The deck trembled. The water retreated.
"Jesus, Mary, and Joseph!"
yelled a voice next to him. Mr. Onyango, the skinny cook.
"It's picking us up!"
They both let themselves slide to the rail and used it to walk themselves toward the lifeboat.
"Let it drop," Hagen shouted. "It's our only chance."
Kazuya's eyes went wide. Hagen twisted around and screamed. Katanga looked over his shoulder and up. The tentacle curled down, already 3 or 4 yards from him. He stumbled back and watched the tree trunk of green flesh wrap around Mr. Onyango, covering him almost head to toe, and yank him away. They watched the man's feet kick once, twice. He vanished into the flesh. Something fluttered down through the wind to smack against the railing and disappear into the waves below. One of Mr. Onyango's black tennis shoes ripped apart and empty. Something grabbed Katanga by the back, pulling his hoodie and shirt tight across his chest, and he felt his boots leave the deck. He screamed in horror, even as the wild, desperate thought, "Please, not like this," burned across his mind. He tilted to the left, up over the railing, caught a glimpse of Hagen with his arms up, and realized the captain had thrown him off Makara and into the churning sea. He hit the water, and it swallowed him up, swallowed all the noise and chaos, just him and the sound of bubbles rushing past his ears. The cool ocean filled his boots and jeans and hoodie, gently pulled him down, offering even more peace. And then a groan of straining metal echoed through the water, like a mechanical whale throwing itself up onto the beach to die. He heard and felt the muffled splash of something else hitting the surface, and more bubbles as it plunged past him. The water tugged at him again, urging him to follow the mystery object into the depths. Katanga found the light, kicked free of the gentle pull, and reached the surface just in time for a wave to smack him in the face and push him back under. He shoved his hands down at the water, clawed his way back up. Then he was in the air, and the rain and the screaming surrounded him again. Something smashed into the water just 2 or 3 wave swells away. The rust-red storage container bobbed once and drifted down. Another container landed on top of it with a muffled clang, rolled off and plunged into the water an arm's reach away from Katanga. He felt it drag against his legs and chest as it sank, sucking away a little more of his body heat with its downward current.
"Help!"
he shouted as loud as he could, spitting out salt water as he did.
"Somebody, please help!"
"Over here,"
somebody responded.
"Here!"
He threw himself across a wave toward the voice. Something else splashed into the water behind him. The wind dragged waves across him like sheets of rain. The ocean rose, fell, and revealed Kazuya clutching a lifebuoy. The second officer clawed at the bright orange ring, trying to hold onto it and pull it over his shoulders at the same time. Their eyes met.
"Katanga!"
he bawled. Katanga kicked at the waves, pushing himself toward the other man.
"Where is everyone?"
"I don't know!"
A groan of metal came from somewhere above them, and another storage container plummeted out of the sky. It flattened a wave and sprayed them with water. It rolled twice in the water, like a crocodile drowning its prey, then sank beneath the surface. Katanga turned back to the helmsman and caught a glimpse of another figure rising up on a wave, facing the other way.
"Captain!" he yelled. "Captain!"
Hagen thrashed around in the water and found them. He took six long strokes, slid down a wave, and came to rest near them. He raised his chin to Katanga.
"Who else?"
"Nobody."
"I thought I saw Joseph," said Kazuya. "But he went under. I think he got snagged on a container."
As if to drive the point home, a bright yellow shipping container crashed into the water near them.
"We have to get to the island," yelled Katanga. "Where is it? What direction?"
Hagen twisted to the left, then turned himself in a slow circle. He let a wave lift him up.
"Where's Makara?"
"What?
Where's my ship?"
Another container crashed down into the water just a few yards away, straight down. Katanga caught a quick glimpse of dull blue steel with white serial numbers and ragged edges where the container had been ripped in half, or chewed and spit out. He looked up. The creature loomed over them. It could have been 50 feet up or 500. Its wings filled the sky. Its bony arms reached down to drag through the waves even as its tentacles curled down and back up. One of them, Katanga was pretty sure, held a huge shark that vanished up into the mass of writhing flesh.
"Where's my goddamn ship?" Hagen yelled again.
The massive wings pushed down, and Katanga felt his ears pop as the pressure changed. More wind raked across the waves, spraying them with salt water. He felt a chill dance down from his fingers into his thighs and shake its way out into the ocean, taking a little more warmth with him.
"Jesus, no!"
cried Kazuya as one of the tentacles plunged down to grab him. The lifebuoy dropped down as the helmsman rose out of the water and vanished into the column of green flesh. A shadow fell over Katanga and he twisted around, letting himself sink down low into the water. Better to freeze and drown than to be eaten. The orange shape loomed over him, rocking on the waves.
"Oh, thank you, holy Jesus," yelled Hagen.
The lifeboat drifted past them. Katanga saw a pair of jagged edges where it had ripped free of the davits, cracking its fiberglass hull in the process. The rear hatch banged open and shut against its frame. Hagen reached it first. He grabbed a railing, got another hand on a higher rung, and dragged himself out of the water. One of his legs kicked up into the open hatch, bracing the door open. He swung back around, found Katanga, and reached out an arm.
"Come on!"
he shouted. Katanga took a deep breath and threw his own arm out, scooping at the water in a clumsy dog paddle. A wave lifted him up and set him down a good 7 or 8 feet closer. Katanga saved his strength, ready to ride the next wave, and one of the massive tentacles folded around Hagen's outstretched arm and yanked the captain away. Gone. Katanga twisted, looked up at the vast belly of the creature above him, but couldn't see his captain anywhere. The Leviathan reached down and scooped up something at least a quarter mile away. A wave lifted him up. He kicked, thrashed, and came less than a yard from the lifeboat. All of the back end was a gaping hole, dissolved away when the tentacle brushed against it. He pushed himself through the water, reached up for what was left of the railing, stopped. Katanga let his arm drift back down, clawed at the water, and turned himself around. The thing, the monstrous thing in the sky, had mostly moved past. Its long, twisting tail stretched across the clouds above him. The head with all its tentacles looked to be maybe half a mile away. He still couldn't get a sense of scale, and thinking about it too much made his head hurt. As he watched, the impossibly huge wings swept down again, and more of the tentacles curled into the water. How many tentacles did the damn thing have? Dozens more than any creature he'd ever seen. They curled back up and he caught glimpses of things folded into the green flesh before they vanished altogether. He looked around. No sign of Makara anywhere. No sign of anyone else in the water with him. Numbness prickled at his toes and fingers. Each wave bobbing him up and down carried a little more heat away with it. He wouldn't freeze to death, but he wouldn't last much more than an hour, maybe two, in the ocean. How far off was the island? The monster forced its way through the sky, shoving clouds out of the way. One of its bony arms reached down, grabbed something, carried it back up to the body. Another waterspout swirled up and vanished against the beast's flesh. The wings shifted, came down again, and the monster banked slowly to the right. Katanga turned himself in the water, faced the bright orange lifeboat again. He shot a last glance up over his shoulder, then reached out to grab at the steel railing. A wave lifted him up, pushed him closer, and he hooked his arm across the rail. Cold and terror had sapped most of his strength. 10 minutes of treading water in a rough ocean had claimed the rest. The gaping hole to the inside tempted him. Seats, a heater, emergency blankets, a small engine to get him the hell away from here. Also a narrow aisle between the chairs, a cramped helm, and the small engine had been loud as hell the last time they tested it. If it grabbed the lifeboat, he'd never get away in time. His legs and bits still hung in the water, but hanging on the back end at least gave him the chance to drop away if the beast reached for the boat. If it moved further away, he might risk it. Lightning showed him the churning clouds above and the vast expanse of ocean around him. Another bolt flashed, and Katanga tried to spot anything on the surface of the water. Floating containers, another lifeboat, wreckage, bodies. Nothing. No one. He followed the length of the beast to its distant head and saw it reach down into the water with tentacles and long claws. It dragged the storm in its wake, taking the wind and rain and lightning with it as it sailed away. The air and sea twisted and spun around it, trying and failing to escape its pull. Thunder rolled across the ocean again. The lifeboat rocked in the waves, lifting Katanga up out of the water and then dipping him back down. He watched the distant monster and tried to decide if it was distant enough. How far was far enough with something this size? He looked away, heaved himself up high enough to see across the lifeboat, and saw the island. Katanga took a breath and flexed his arms, heaving himself up over the railing, through the half-melted hole, and into the lifeboat. 18. Veek speed-walked through the jungle. She wanted to run. She really wanted to run. Normally, she avoided running whenever she could. At best, it left her aching and gasping for air. At worst, it set off an asthma attack and left her, well, gasping for air much more desperately. Right now, though, she'd be willing to risk it, if only her goddamned hands weren't cuffed behind her back. It made it tough to keep up any sort of rhythm. Her shoulders and hips fought her for balance, each with her own ideas of how she needed to move. Every quick shift or dodge threatened to send her tumbling and drove home the fact that she wouldn't be able to catch herself if she fell. It also didn't help that without her glasses she couldn't focus on anything near her. The distant trees and grass stayed sharp, but as they worked their way closer, they softened. Everything around her feet was a blur, and she'd already mistaken two rocks for patches of flat dirt, leading to more balance-threatening stumbles. So she pressed her hands against her butt, kept her back straight, and moved as fast as she could away from the family. After a few minutes of running, she made a sharp left turn around a clump of dark, probably volcanic rocks. She'd taken a few online classes on how to lose a tail, and she hoped the basic ideas that worked in a city also held on a tropical island. The family might not be after her right now, but odds were good as soon as that little firefight ended, they'd make time to hunt her down, so getting as far away as possible while leaving as little trail as possible was her main concern. The other big concern, of course, was that Veek had no idea where to get away to. She knew she was on an island, knew the family was here. And the roaches were here, the goddamned cockroaches, which meant this island was... well, exactly what Veek feared it was. Unless the family had screwed up. She could always hold out hope for that. After all, it had taken them almost a century to make any headway back in Los Angeles. But unless they'd really screwed up, Veek felt pretty confident she was about 950 miles east-southeast of Madagascar. And the whole world had no idea how much trouble it was in. In a perfect world, if she was crazy lucky, Nate, Mike, Zila, and the rest of her friends were just a few hours behind her. They'd tracked a license plate or a flight number or something. Mike caught that sort of stuff all the time, and then Nate would have had Reggie Magnus call in favors from the Marines again, or the DOD, or that weird guy with the cookie fetish, Saint-Germain, who they had quarterly meetings with. Right now, they could all be in a military helicopter with a lot of big guns heading straight for this island. Straight for her. If she was crazy lucky. But she wasn't going to bet on it. She passed a cluster of bamboo and shifted direction again, back to the right, splitting the difference, still heading away from the family, but not in the direction she'd left them. She lurched a little too far forward and had to thrust one leg and her hips out to catch herself, like some sort of yoga lunge. Veek steadied herself, straightened her back, and resumed her hasty walk. The family's boat was here. Ship? Yacht? Whatever it was, it would have a radio. Or maybe she'd be really lucky and one of them left their smartphone behind so it wouldn't get wet. Would there still be people on board? She'd gotten the sense all the people on the yacht had been family members, and it seemed like they'd all come on shore to the island. Maybe she could circle back to the beach and get out to the yacht, maybe even get it far enough from shore that they couldn't swim to it. Of course, the family wanted to be on the island, so that didn't accomplish much. Also, she was willing to bet driving a yacht was at least as complicated as driving stick, which she wouldn't be good at. And based off what the guy Murdoch had told her when he brought her to the beach, she'd have to get the yacht really far from shore to make sure none of them could swim to it, like over the horizon far. Maybe she could just find a damned handcuff key. The other option, of course, was to look for, well, the other pole. Maybe there'd be something near it she could use to free herself or call for help. But if the family was tracking her through the jungle, that would also mean leading them right to it. She switched directions again, going sharp right, and she hoped more or less back to the beach. The yacht idea sucked, but it was the best and safest one she had, barring some kind of divine intervention or... The translucent thing spilled out from behind a tree in front of her, like some kind of multi-legged Zerg monster with a cloaking field. It surged silently across her path, stretching out and pausing to let its back legs catch up. Veek took a quick step back, then another, and then the thing rolled over her like a glowing cloud of warm smoke. She retreated again, something caught her foot, and she tripped over the one goddamned root in the whole jungle. She fell. The forest spun around her, and her stomach wrung itself tight, squeezing its contents in both directions. She clenched her jaw, saw a tree trunk rushing up at her, and felt it smack the side of her head. Her shoulder hit the ground first. She flopped onto her chest and knocked the air from her lungs. She wheezed twice, and another pulse of nausea ran from her stomach up to her head and back as she rolled onto her side. The glistening, translucent thing had vanished. She heard noise, grass rustling behind her, and twisted around to look, but all she could see from the ground was a blurry wall of tall grass and scrub plants. Veek pulled her knees up toward her belly, rolled forward again, and got her legs under her. A few awkward lunges got one of her feet placed right, and she pushed herself up onto one knee. It slid in the thin coat of mud covering the ground. A strong wind had replaced the translucent creature, rustling the grass and even making the trees sway. Clouds darkened the sky. A heavy mist, almost rain, pattered down on her. She'd heard tropical storms could move in fast, but had she passed out? How hard had she hit her head on that tree? It had seemed like a bump at the time, but it might have just been adrenaline, fight or flight letting her ignore the pain. She couldn't even remember walking close to it. The wind died down just for a moment, and then she heard another echo from somewhere. Bells. Little chiming bells, like stores hung over doorways to announce customers. She let her head hang low and took a few slow, deep breaths to calm the tickle in her throat. She closed her eyes and tried her best to be calm. When her breathing steadied, she opened her eyes. A pale cube sat by her foot, half under some leafy plant spreading out near the base of the tree. She tapped it with her foot, watched it rock back and forth, got a sense of its weight. She straightened her neck, tried to put a little more distance between the wooden cube and her eyes, and squinted. Not a cube, a block. A water-stained and faded toy block. The upright face had some red paint in a line, maybe a capital I or a 1. Another side had the faint remains of a blue A, or maybe it was a V. She moved the block around again and revealed a side with 3 miraculously bright lines of green paint, 3 capital I's. Roman numerals? Veek twisted around for a moment, trying to get her hands close to the block, but gave up after a few seconds. With the cuffs on, there'd be no way to grab it without sitting down flat on the muddy ground, and then she'd be stuck with it in her hands, assuming she'd be able to get back up without dropping it. She hoped it wasn't some quest item she'd need later. She pushed herself all the way to her feet. The mist had already built a few heavy drips on her face, and she could feel it dampening her jacket. She shook the water away and looked around again, getting her bearings. She'd fallen with her head that way and fallen backward, which meant that was the direction she'd come from. More or less. Maybe. She turned slowly, looking for something she could remember passing, any kind of recognizable landmark, and had to admit she hadn't been paying attention to anything. Her focus had just been on getting away and not falling while she did. And she'd been doing about half of that right so far. Veek turned to look behind her again, then struck off into the jungle, hoping she wasn't heading right back toward the family.
19. Anne kept staring at the Seraphs in a way that reminded Murdoch way too much of a star-struck teenager meeting a pop icon. The most honest smile he'd seen from her in weeks spread across her face, and her words had a babbling quality. Not the old tongue, but more of a random train of thought. Granted, most of the others weren't acting much better. Rachel had dropped to her knees in the tall grass. Claudia's arm hung limp from her wounded shoulder, and she held it in place with her other hand, but she almost seemed happy now that she knew what had attacked her. She and Barnabas both had their heads bowed, muttering non-stop prayers next to the spear that had almost impaled her. Daniel and Phoebe stood there with their expressions shifting from nervousness to rapture and back. The Seraphs bothered Murdoch more, though. Their malformed brows furrowed and their triple eyes blinked in a 1-2-3 pattern. They stared down at Anne, gazed at the others and adjusted their fingers on their long spears. An anxious energy filled the air. Like a cat trying to decide if it was done playing with a mouse or not, and how it wanted to end the game. One of the Seraphs, a lanky brute with one particularly long tusk in its gnashing mouth, focused on Murdoch. They'd all noticed him, not bowing and praying, like the others. He met Tusk's gaze and tried to keep his expression as neutral as possible, and keep his hand near his holstered pistol. His heart beat at least a dozen times before Tusk shifted its attention over to Barnabas. Its eyes moved one at a time, the last lingering on Murdoch for what felt like far too long. He relaxed a little but didn't move his hand away from his pistol. Then his own eyes flicked over to Abe's body, held upright by the spear through his chest. The pistol wouldn't do Murdoch any good when the Seraphs could throw their spears that fast and hard. Having it close to his hand still made him feel better, though. Anne coughed out a few more syllables, paused, then repeated them with a slight variation. The lead Seraph loomed over her. It stood a foot taller than the others, and it kept its oversized hood pulled low over its face. The shadows stretched down to its array of teeth, and Murdoch could just see the gleam of eyes under the hood's ragged hem. The hood barked out a few words at Anne. Its voice was so harsh it almost sounded mechanical. Each syllable sounded like it had been dragged across a steel rasp. Murdoch tried to remember what he'd learned of the old tongue, but it had been so many years and he'd never used it. The words were vaguely familiar, but he couldn't guess at what they meant. Anne's hands came up and did something in front of her body, between her and the hood. Her fingers dropped lower, then lower again. By the time Murdoch recognized the motions, she'd gone almost to her waist. He hadn't seen her do it in years. Anne pulled her shirt out of her jeans, then shrugged it off her shoulders. She let the sleeves slide down her arms and over her hands. It dropped to the ground, leaving her bare in front of the hood. Murdoch's breath caught, just for a moment, at the sight of the broad swath of once familiar skin. Anne raised her arms, laced her fingers on top of her head, and took in a deep breath. Her skin fluttered along her ribs. With the second breath, her gills waved open and shut, like a fish drowning in the air. She swayed for a moment, then took a third breath, letting them open wide, displaying herself to the Seraphs. The hood reached out a too long, gaunt finger tipped with a claw-like nail. It brushed the jagged edge along one of the flaps of skin, and Anne trembled, the nervous shiver of someone being tickled. Yes, Murdoch decided. Best to think of it as a nervous shiver and not something else. One of the Seraphs barked out a few words, and Tusk added a few more. The hood lifted its hand and grabbed Anne's chin with its skeletal fingers. It turned her head to the left and right, staring into her eyes. Then it released her and coughed up a single, sharp syllable. Murdoch couldn't read their expressions, but their bodies loosened, their hands relaxed, the tips of their spears lifted up, the butts resting against the ground. Murdoch caught a last three-eyed glare from Tusk before the Seraph stood its spear up straight, like some sort of palace guard. Anne babbled out a quartet of sounds, paused, then tried again with a different one on the end. The hood blinked its eyes at her. She half turned her head back to the family.
I did warn you all I was a bit rusty in the old tongue. This might take a little while.
It got a nervous laugh from Claudia and Daniel. The others stayed quiet. Barnabas and Phoebe had both averted their eyes when Anne took her shirt off. Anne spoke again. The hood stood there, one of its eyes, its largest one, focused on one family member after another, but kept coming back to Anne, topless before it. Murdoch couldn't shake the disturbing idea. It was less like ogling and more like someone picking a lobster from a restaurant fish tank. Anne turned her head again.
Murdoch,
she called out.
Bring our specialist up here. I'm trying to explain what we're looking for, and I'd like a better sense of what it might look like.
Barnabas glanced back at Murdoch, at Abe's impaled body, at the clear lack of Veek in the surrounding area. Their eyes met, and Murdoch could see Barnabas was trying very hard to set him on fire with his gaze. Murdoch cleared his throat.
She got away, Minister.
Anne's shoulders twisted back, exposing more of her gills. If Barnabas wanted to set Murdoch on fire, Anne was determined to burn a hole straight through his head. Other eyes fell on him as the family turned to stare.
What was that?
Any trace of warmth and familiarity had vanished from her voice. She sounded like one of the elders she and Murdoch had mocked as kids when they were feeling extra rebellious, or scared, or ashamed. Murdoch met her stare for a moment, then looked over at Abe's body.
During the attack, she said nothing. During the attack, she took advantage of the confusion and Abraham's death. She attacked me and ran into the woods.
He could feel the family judging him as he spoke. Anne rolled her fingers into fists. She turned even more, exposing herself to Murdoch, and unease skittered across his shoulders like a handful of harbinger cockroaches. Her expression, the way she held herself, the attitude rolling off her like clouds off dry ice, it all came into sharp focus. The woman standing in front of Murdoch was not the girl he'd been in love with all those years ago, not even remotely. He'd always had trouble reading her, but he'd let old memories and emotions blind him to who she was now.
Well,
Anne said,
go after her.
He looked through the trees in the direction he thought Veek had run.
How am I supposed to find her?
The island's barely 3 miles across, she snapped. Look.
He nodded.
Now, find her.
Murdoch winced, took a step, and caught his ankle on the shaft of the spear holding up Abe's body. He stumbled but caught himself before he fell. The impact knocked Abe's claw-like hand loose, and it swung down to hang limp at his side.
Go!
Roared Anne. Murdoch ran into the forest, away from the monsters. 20. Seth glanced back over his shoulder as they ran through the wind-whipped jungle. His pom-pom bounced back and forth with each stride.
What the hell was that thing?
He shouted back at Chase. Chase stumbled over a rock half hidden in the knee-high grass. They'd been running as best they could for 10 minutes now, but he wasn't sure how far they'd actually gone from the beach. They slogged along, and the forest countered all their best attempts to sprint. Hell, Doug had managed to stay ahead of them, and he was just plodding along in a determined, stomping march. Seth threw more questions.
Where did it come from? Was it under the sea? Is it an alien?
Chase looked back himself, half expecting to see the impossibly huge tentacled thing looming over the treetops. If it could pick up a ship the size of the Makara, could they do anything to stop it? Without the ship, did they have any chance of getting away from it?
I don't know.
What did he say it was?
Seth waved an arm back behind them.
The man on the beach.
He didn't. He just said we'd be safe at the center of the island.
Doug stomped his stomping walk and whipped around. The misting rain had softened the lines of blood on his face, but they still left trails down to his chin like dark tears.
There's nowhere safe, he snapped. Nowhere.
Then go back to the beach,
growled Seth. Chase took Doug's arm.
Come on, he said. We've got to keep moving.
Doug shook his head, and the movement squeezed a few more drops of fresh blood from the corners of his eyes.
There's no point. There's nowhere safe. It'll find us. It's going to find everyone.
He wrapped his arms around himself and looked up through the trees, up at the sky. Chase pulled.
Come on.
Doug's head drifted side to side.
They're going to find everyone and eat everything. We can't get away.
He took a step back the way they'd come.
We don't have time for this, said Seth.
A minute ago you didn't know what the hell it was, said Chase. Now you're the expert on how much time we've got.
He gave Doug's arm another tug. Seth growled, but he waited.
Nothing gets away from them, murmured Doug. They're going to eat it all.
Come on, Chase said to him. Let's get moving.
Doug kept his bleeding eyes on the sky, but he let Chase lead him away. A palm frond whipped through the air and crashed into the ground just ahead of them. Seth flinched, swore at it, and gave it a kick. He glared back at Chase and Doug, then grabbed for his pistol. Chase heard rustling behind them, the low thud of heavy steps, and spun around. He fumbled at the gun tucked in his waistband. A figure wobbled between the trees, following the rough trail their feet had beaten into the grass and weeds. It tried to hold itself as upright as possible while it moved and bobbed awkwardly side to side because of it. Chase saw dark hair and tanned skin and for an instant thought the man from the beach had followed and caught up to them, but this figure wore a dark jacket and stood much too short and was clean-shaven and was also, he realized as she got closer, a woman. Seth stepped toward her, his pistol out.
"Who are you?"
he called out over the wind. The woman stopped a few yards away, her arms tucked behind her back. She squinted at the three of them, suspiciously, and took a long look at Doug's blood-streaked face before focusing on Seth and his pistol again.
"Who are you?"
"You first, and show me your hands."
"I can't."
A gust of wind sliced through the trees, and they all flinched from the rain that briefly hit, like the spray from a garden hose.
"We're from the Makara," said Chase.
Seth glared at him. The woman raised one eyebrow.
"The what?"
"It's a freighter anchored about 3 miles offshore."
"Why are you all bloody?"
Chase glanced at Seth.
"A friend of ours was killed. We tried to save him."
"Killed by what?"
"A trap."
She stared at each of them, peering intently into Chase's eyes. Her shoulders dropped a tiny bit, but she kept her hands behind her back. When she had examined each of them, she looked back at Chase.
"You didn't come on the yacht?"
Seth perked up and let the pistol drift down.
"What yacht?"
The woman took a cautious step forward.
"We came here on a yacht, I think from Madagascar. It's in a cove or a lagoon or something on the west side of the island."
"Who's we?" asked Chase. "How'd you end up out here in the jungle?"
"I was running away from them."
Seth looked past her.
"From who?"
"The people who kidnapped me. They grabbed me in L.A. and brought me here."
She studied Doug's face again.
"They call themselves the Family."
Chase caught the heavy emphasis, a clear capital letter at the start of the word.
"Is that some sort of cult thing?"
She shrugged awkwardly, still keeping her hands behind her back.
"Yeah, sure, you could call them that."
"Wait a minute," said Seth. "Are you tied up?"
"Handcuffed."
She twisted her body around and wiggled her fingers at him.
"I mentioned the whole getting kidnapped thing, right?"
"Are you okay?"
asked Chase.
"Don't suppose you've got a key?"
Seth smirked.
"What kind of amateur needs a key to open handcuffs?"
Another blast of wind and rain ripped through the forest. Chase turned his head, protecting his wounded ear from the pelting drops. The woman staggered forward. Doug mumbled words that got carried away before anyone could hear them.
"You should come with us," said Chase. "It's safe at the center of the island."
She raised an eyebrow.
"Safe?"
"It won't matter," said Doug. "We'll explain on the way."
Chase held out a hand.
"You with us?"
"I guess so. You're my best option at the moment."
She took a few steps forward.
"I'm Veek."
"Chase."
"Can we get moving now?"
Seth waved them onward, his gaze drifting upward as he did. Chase kept one hand on Doug's arm and nodded at Veek.
"You want a hand for balance?"
"You going to perp walk me?"
"Figured beats picking you up 2 or 3 times.
"Yeah, whatever."
He hooked a hand under her arm, a loose grip but ready to grab tight if she slipped. They fell in step behind Seth, traveling with long strides.
"This is Doug,"
Chase said. He nodded up ahead.
"That's Seth."
She looked over at Doug.
"What happened to him?"
"We're not really sure."
"He looked at that thing for too long,"
Seth called back over his shoulder. Chase felt Veek's arm and torso tense.
"What thing?"
she asked.
"The thing up in the sky."
Her arm tensed even more. It felt stiff beneath Chase's fingers.
"A monster?"
He nodded.
You saw it too?
They all ducked their heads as a sheet of rain crashed down on them and then another one. Doug closed his eyes but kept looking up. It cleaned his face off, if nothing else. Veek looked back and forth between them.
Who are you people?
I told you, I'm Chase. He's Seth.
No, I mean, who are you with? Why are you on this island?
With?
Makara is a private subcontractor, said Seth. I'm crew, they were passengers. One of our engines blew out and left us stranded. The captain sent us here to this island for safety while they rode out the storm and made repairs.
Chase pictured the huge thing in the sky, reaching for the Makara, and wondered if the repairs had ever been finished, or if they ever would be. The rain tapered off, and so did the wind. Seth charged forward, and Chase tried to hurry the others along to keep up. The wet grass clung to them as they waded through it. Veek tried to high-step, leaning against his hand to keep her balance. Did the lack of wind mean the monster had left, taking its clouds and storm with it, or were they in the eye of the storm? He glanced up, peering at the sky through the treetops, wondering if the tentacled thing was right above them. But he only saw clouds and a glimmer of sunshine. They marched along for another 5 minutes when Chase noticed the lack of trees. The nice, even distribution Iman had noticed before had disappeared. No bamboo, either. He glanced over his shoulder and saw the line of trunks a few yards behind him. They'd walked into a clearing without even realizing it. Of course, it wasn't exactly a clearing that implied a big, open space. The rough circle of trees wasn't empty. Seth glanced over his shoulder at them.
You think this is what the guy was talking about?
It took Chase a moment to recognize the block. What looked like decades, maybe centuries, of moss and vines and other plants had all but covered it, blurring the edges and camouflaging the shape. Three palm trees grew along its edge and pressed up against it as they stretched up to the sky. Around 40 feet tall, maybe just as much across, and he hadn't noticed the frigging thing until he was standing 10 or 12 feet away from it.
What the hell is it?
Murmured Veek. Seth took a few steps forward, staring up at the huge shape. Veek shook herself free from Chase's arm and took a few cautious steps of her own. Even Doug swept his eyes back and forth across it, finally looking at something besides the sky. Chase tried to focus past the plants and get a sense of the huge block's true shape. It looked too regular, the edges too straight to be a natural formation. In his first months of travel, he'd carried 3 or 4 guidebooks with him, and this reminded him of the glossy pictures of places like Bang Melea and Angkor Wat, overgrown stone temples and palaces, all but buried by nature. He stepped to the side, then stepped again. The gigantic block stretched back twice as far as it did across. Not a cube, but more of a huge, boxy slab.
It's got to be man-made, he said. At least shaped or carved by someone.
Veek scuffed at the moss with her heels, knocking some of it loose and exposing a swath of gray.
Not carved, she said, squinting at the coarse material. It's made of concrete.
Really?
Concrete or cement, it's definitely not rock.
Okay, said Chase. Maybe it's an old war bunker or fort someone built out here on this island, something like that.
Maybe. Huh.
What?
Veek prodded at something near the base of the wall with her toe, then rolled it out into the open. Her foot stretched back and dragged something else out.
Wooden blocks. For kids. You know, like you find at an old war bunker.
He stepped to join her and crouched down. One of the blocks had a faint bit of green on one edge and a faded but legible number 3 in red. The other one's marks had survived a bit better, on 3 of the sides anyway, and it only took Chase a moment to recognize the symbols for division, addition,
and equals.
We found one like these out in the jungle, he said. But it had Greek letters. I think Doug's got it.
I found one with Roman numerals,
Veek said.
Do you have it with you?
She raised an eyebrow at him and turned her hips so he could see her cuffed hands.
How would I bring it with me?
Sorry. Are there more of them?
Just saw the two.
Chase shuffled closer to the wall and rooted through the underbrush. His fingers brushed something solid, and he pulled out a third block with blue and yellow markings. Then a small wooden horse, or maybe it was supposed to be a donkey. And then another block. Water spots seeped into each toy, and in places, the wood grain swelled and came apart like a fraying rope.
Somebody left all their toys out in the rain,
murmured Veek. She kicked at more of the moss and tried to scrape some of the smaller vines away.
What do you think this is?
It must be the safe place he was talking about.
Who?
The guy on the beach.
What guy on...
It's not enough, said Doug, shaking his head. It won't be enough.
It's made of bricks over here, called out Seth.
He pulled some more of the vines away from the block and waved at the exposed red rectangles. Chase left Veek clearing off the concrete and walked toward Seth. Halfway there, he noticed something else in the overgrowth, hidden between the two tall trees pressing up against the huge shape. A curved expanse of bricks, maybe 6 feet across, stretched between two vine and moss-covered shapes. Only a few creepers reached across the bricks, just enough to break up its outline, and the outline of the layer above it. By the third step, they blended into the greater mass of the block and its surrounding vegetation. He counted 4, 5, 6 steps total, and by then, he saw the railings wrapped in vines, and the door. Not a hatch or a blast door, just a regular wooden door. Maybe a little wider than normal. It had a latch on one side and a small window in the center. A concrete lintel stretched above it, supported by two sets of pillars. Seth closed the distance between them and followed Chase's stare.
What is this?
He stepped forward and pulled some of the creepers away from the concrete banister on one side of the small staircase. A trio of bright green cockroaches scurried out from beneath the leaves, their legs a blur of motion. Two headed for the ground while the other one headed up toward the door. Not a staircase, thought Chase. He'd seen this basic setup before countless times back in Houston, in every city he'd ever visited. It was a stoop. He pulled another handful of leaves off the banister, then stepped back and looked up at the block. He picked out elements of the facade behind the vines. He found the sills and boarded-up windows flanking the door and stretching up across the front of the structure. Veek made a small choking sound, then followed it up with,
Oh my God.
It's a building, said Chase. It's an old apartment building.
21. They all stared up at the vine-covered shape.
What's an apartment building doing here?
Asked Seth.
I have no idea, Chase said.
We're in the middle of nowhere,
insisted the deckhand, as if it would change things. Veek stared up at the building with the same confusion. Not just confusion, amazement. Her eyes were as wide at the building as Doug's had been at the monster in the sky. Chase touched her arm.
Do you know something about this?
She shook her head and her shoulders swayed back and forth.
I can honestly say I'm as surprised and baffled as you.
Chase glanced at her hands, still cuffed behind her back, then over at Seth. Can you get her out of those? Seth studied the handcuffs for a few seconds and shrugged.
We still don't know who she is.
I still don't know who you are either,
said Veek.
I feel better leaving her cuffed.
Does that mean you can't actually get them off?
I can do it, Seth said. I just feel better with you wearing them.
Seriously? Said Chase.
She's half your size. Literally, half.
She's also right here in front of you,
Veek said.
Sorry. And believe me, I'm not who you need to be worried about.
That's very true, said Doug. He'd slumped against the concrete banister, letting himself sink into the leaves and vines. His breathing seemed slower, his movements less twitchy. Seth gestured at the building.
You think this is the place?
It must be. Chase waved a hand to the cuffs. And if it isn't, we want to be able to move as fast as possible, right?
We still have him to deal with. Seth tipped his head toward Doug.
I'm feeling much better. Doug waved a dismissive hand. I just
lost it for a few seconds there.
For about 20 minutes, said Seth.
I'm okay now. There's nothing wrong with me.
Plus,
Veek added, nodding her head at Doug,